Knife Talk, sponsored by Evenheat, the manufacturers of the finest knife heat treat ovens available. Find your next heat treat oven at evenheat-kiln.com.
So welcome to Knife Talk, the all new Knife Talk. So yeah, things are very different. So it's myself, we got Jeff. Say hi, Jeff.
How are you? This is a cheeky podcast we're about to do.
It is, without Mareko. Without Mareko. He doesn't. So those who don't know, Mareko's doing it. What's he calling it? Some sort of couteau de tour, something like that, isn't it?
I tried to say what it was in French, and it sounded. I have no idea. I don't. That whole expression makes no sense to me.
Well, I think it's couteau. So knife in French is couteau. So it's something to do with the knives and being on tour, which sounds like fun to me. Sounds like fun.
Yeah, he started out in Los Angeles, and he was with APL and Jimmy Kimmel and Jason Bateman, and then he was on the Joe Rogan Experience. He did a great job right before Elon did his thing, and Elon Musk was on the night before. I actually texted Mareko right before he went on, and I said, "Don't worry, you don't have any problems. Elon Musk is going on tomorrow night." I think I screwed him up, and then he went to. He was with the Artistry. Was that what they call it? What's his name? At Artistry.
I don't know.
You know what I'm talking about. He was with this incredible knife maker. I don't know. I forgot. I couldn't pronounce his name. And then now he's at he's in Hawaii with Neil Kamamura.
Not a bad gig. Not a bad gig at all.
Outstanding. And he's going to come back, and we're going to make this thing happen.
Exactly. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to have the show is going to be myself, Jeff, and Mareko. It's going to be a weekly show. So we're going to record on Friday. It'll go live on a Monday. So you guys have got something to listen to every week. Should be fun.
Very exciting. Very exciting. Once again, thank you very much for this opportunity. I'll try not to let you down.
The pleasure is all mine. All mine. So let's talk about this new format. So let's tell people why we're doing this. I mean, to me, it's, you know, I got bored of doing... of just questions and answers, you know, a different person every week.
Yeah.
Just got a little bit boring, running out of questions to ask. I just think, you know, we could have a broader appeal. So as well as, you know, knife makers, which, you know, have already been listening to the show and, you know, really thankful for every single person that listens. I think, you know, there's lots of people just interested in knives, you know, just general knife users. There's chefs or anybody with a vague interest in knives. I want this show to sort of appeal to them.
Well, I just want to thank you right off the bat because, you know, you did a hard job. When it comes to broadcasting, you're trying to create chemistry with someone. And every week, all those 30 episodes, you had to create brand new chemistry with someone that you'd never really talked to before. So with that said, it's a lot harder than people realize when you did what you did. So you don't sell yourself short here. You had to, like, start from scratch every episode.
Mm. Well, it certainly wasn't every week. The distance between each episode got longer and longer. So yeah, we're going to be doing this every week. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, I'm psyched. We're going to have a good time.
So what have you been up to this week? What's the Lord Fader been doing this week?
It's been mania over here. It's been total mania. I my poor business partner Tony is having panic attacks. Well, panic attacks is a strong expression. He's getting we're getting bombarded. Things have been good. We've been getting some good news lately. We were in the New York Times last week. That was really great. It was about Peekskill, but they threw me in, and I actually the funny part about that is I got in a fight with the fight is a strong word too. I got into a disagreement with the. Reporter and copy editor. They didn't like my terminology. So, and this brings it back to regards to my opinion of what I think is important about this podcast is she was referring to what I was doing as melting stuff down and melding it back together, meld with an M. Mm-hmm. And I had to say, no, this is what we're doing. We're heating it up, forging it down, and we're doing whatever. And it was this fight. She said, well, the copy editor says that's not really how it works. And I'm like, well, you bring the copy editor up here, and I'll tell the copy editor what we're doing. So it's interesting because in regards to this is I like the idea that we're trying to help people understand what we're doing and give them a better understanding of what we're going to be doing. And then they have a better education in regards to what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. And we want it to be as, you know, interactive as possible.
So, yeah, for
you know,
sure.
I've had messages from people saying, "What, you know, make it a video," and you know, that would be great. But, you know, we're in different countries.
And, let's just get the audio down first. We'll get the audio down, and then we'll see where we're at.
Exactly. But yeah, people can ask us questions, and we've received a ton already. Yeah. So, you know, send those questions in. And we're not the experts by any means.
No.
But we've done this. You know, we've done this for some time, and, you know, we have ways of doing things ourselves, and hopefully it'll start a conversation with others, and we'll learn, they'll learn. It's good for everyone.
Well, the other thing is if we don't know, we'll try to find out. Or we know enough people that we can ask them. We have a very good, this knife community is an excellent network of people, and I try to be as helpful as possible, but if I don't know, I usually try to ask somebody. So that's what we're going to do. I hate that expression. I say it all the time, but I'm with you. And that whole thing is from the idea of, like, you know, we're all in this together.
Yeah. And, you know, lines of communication are open. So if you hear a question, you have a great answer yourself, or you have a different way of doing things, let us know. Let us know. We'd love to tell everybody else.
And I didn't answer your first question, which was, what have you been doing? I've been working on a pile of knives, including 36 of these Cuban knives, which I've been making with Chef Carl Ruiz. And actually, one of them, by the time this airs, maybe it'll be already been filmed, but one went to Guy Fieri. It was a special one that Carl wanted me to make for Guy. And he says Fieri, I don't know. But it went out to him, and he's out there in California with that knife. And that's nice. I've been working on the Cuban knives.
Are you putting serial numbers on them? Are they all individual numbered? Or?
Yeah, I'm stamping CR for Carl Ruiz. And then I'm numbering each one. And then guys said CR, but not a number. It said four, the number four, and EVA, forever. It was a little special kind of joke. Young kid joke.
Kid speak.
That's it.
Yeah, well, I need to get used to that. So, I mean, what I've been doing this week is I've been in a bloody hospital for most of the week.
Oh, my God.
So I've got twins on the way.
Fantastic news.
Yes, we're very excited, myself and the wife, but she's fine. She's absolutely fine. But we just spent some time in the hospital this week, which was unexpected. So I've been away from the workshop, really. Only coming back today. So it set me back a bit this week, but, you know, raring to go for next week.
Outstanding. Well, that's great. Well, good luck to you. I hope your wife is feeling well, and we're sending all of our kindest regards to her and you.
Thank you very much.
Fantastic news.
So talking about projects and things that we've been doing recently, you were in a great video for Epicurious, which was on YouTube.
It was fine.
It was fine. Yeah, it's fine. A great, great video. But what really entertained me about the video was those comments. And I know you haven't actually read them, have you?
Well, here's a little backup on that video is my buddy Will Griffin of Griffin Knife Works did the first one, and I was actually supposed to do the one that he did, and they got him, and I talked to him. They filmed his first and played his first, and I think it was very depressing for him. He said, just be careful, they're going to talk about your hands. So I was talking to my business partner about it, and I said, I don't think I'm going to read the comments. And he goes, why would you read the comments? Do you walk out on the street and ask strangers what they think of your shirt? Absolutely not. So I haven't really. I've gotten told by some people what has been said, but I haven't actively gone out and I don't want to depress myself.
Well, what if I depress you instead? What if I read the comments to you and this is your way to get back to these people. You can comment back.
This is a terrible idea. I look, for the sake of this podcast, I'll do it, but it's going to be uncomfortable. I'm just telling you that. And in regards to if you made some of these comments and I said something offensive to you, I'm apologizing ahead of time, not afterwards. So,
well, you know, I'm going to name the person. So I've noted a few down. So I'm actually going to name them because I think if they're going to go online and make a comment, they're going to be heard.
So you want me to have my honest opinion of what they have to say?
This is your reply.
This is my reply. All right.
And you will see a theme developing here with most of these comments.
It's going to be hand comments, awful hand comments. And I'll try to go behind the scenes in regards to what happened that day. And
cue the sad music. Cue the sad music.
All right, bring it out. Let him rip. Let him rip.
So Jenna7710 said quite simply, "This man has hideous hands."
Yes, she's not wrong. She's not wrong. True. Yes, this is, you know,
Dr. Genius PhD. I mean, this guy is obviously a genius. He's commenting on YouTube, you know. You couldn't get this guy to clean his fingernails before the shoot.
Look, Dr. Genius isn't wrong. And here's what I'm going to say about that. I was petrified. I had to write this episode. I wrote the outline to this episode. And I was far more concerned about not sounding crazy. This was a sound stage that with like 8 or 10 people, there were cameramen and audio guys. And I was worried about passing out. I literally was worried with all the lights and everything. I was worried about passing out. So you're right. I could have, you know, my hands are bad. You're not wrong.
You're being very kind. You're being very kind to these people.
Well, I mean, you know, it gets to the point where it's like, I mean, what am I going to say? I got great hands. I got terrible hands. He's right. I should have worn gloves. My wife told me weeks before, can't you wear gloves for a few weeks? I'm like, no. I have some permanent, as some of you guys know, some of your fingers get a little close to that grinder. And I think I've destroyed my nail bed. So my nails kind of look like, you know, jagged rocks. Fingernails don't grow out nice. And even if I clean them, they look like terrible.
It's going to happen if you're making knives.
They're not wrong. They're not. So far, I'm not in disagreement.
Danny M. By the way, this dude should have his own YouTube channel.
Ain't happening. I do the Instagram Live and I enjoy doing Instagram Live. I don't have the time to do content. Like, I know a lot of guys, friends of mine, Alec and Zach and all these guys, they do great content. I want to be in the knife business. So I do the Instagram Live, it goes away. I don't have to do any prep. I don't have to do any, you know, editing. And thank you. I'm not going to do it. So forget it.
Katie Merritt says, anyone else getting Chris Pratt vibes from this guy?
No.
And I can totally see it.
No one's getting Chris Pratt. Leave me alone, Katie. Katie, just why are you even responding? Katie, it's over, Katie. Just relax.
Jobel Kitty, which is, great
bring
name.
It.
Cool eye color, yellow green.
What the fuck? What are you looking so hard for? Jesus Christ, these people have nothing better to do. Eye color, fingernails, outrage, total. All right, fine, that's fine.
Fat Rabbit.
Fat Rabbit, baby. Come on, this, Fat Rabbit.
This was insulting to sit through. Oof, burn.
Insulting, he's not wrong. I mean, you know, it's more insulting the fact that he had to comment on it. It's just like, it's fine, it's not for everybody. Fat Rabbit. You know, Fat Rabbit, I don't know what to say. I don't have answers for this. It's not, what am I going to say? You're not wrong, but it's fine. I don't understand why you need to even say anything. I've never in my life thought, this is terrible. Let me let them know. It's just fine.
Well, yeah.
I'm with you. I'm not insulted so far. I'm not really insulted.
Okay, there's plenty more to come. Plenty more.
Yeah, bring it. I'm ready.
Anthony Huff, simply, hands crusty as fuck.
Yeah, they are. You're not wrong. We've already covered that. He's not wrong. It's fine.
Pumpkin pie. Lol. You know, they're obviously very intelligent.
Lol.
You really got to be a dummy to be a knife expert, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. I mean, here's the thing. The dumb part is these people thought that they pulled me off the street and we just kind of riffed for 2 days. We had a very set time. We had 7 hours in the studio. They rented the studio for 7 hours. I showed up at the call time. They had me sitting around for 3 hours because they were setting up the lights and doing the makeup and making sure the sound was good. We had an outline because obviously if you have a set amount of time, you can't just be rambling on and hopefully good stuff comes out. So, you know, I'm not mad at what he said either. You know what? I think it's weird to comment on it. It makes no sense to me. I never really dawned on me that would be something worth your while, your finger. You know, I just don't understand it, but I'm not mad at that so far. So far, keep going. Go ahead.
We've got two more.
Go ahead.
Andre Aspara says, this guy yells, then he whispers, all in the same sentence, and his fingers look like toes.
The last part sucked, but the first part, he's got me. The first part, he's got me. He's got me 100% the first part. It's weird. I just kind of go in and out of strange volume. So the toes, fingers look like toes. It's just like, you know, I mean, fine. I what am I supposed to say? Should my hands be insulted? I don't think so. It's the way it is. It's the way it is. I'm still not 100% insulted. I mean, you know, it doesn't make me feel good, but it's fine. I'll be all right.
This one's going to make you feel good all weekend. This is the last one.
All right,
and
baby.
This is from Nate Davis. You've got a big fan in Nate.
Nate, all right, Nate. Give it to me, Nate.
Simply says, this guy is screaming hot.
Fucking Nate. Oh, baby. Come on, Nate.
You've got
Nate.
A friend in Nate.
Yeah, Nate's, he's into the spent looking guy with the big eye bags.
Yeah, and fingers like
I'm with
toes.
You, Nate. I'm with you, Nate. Yeah, toe finger. Well, I think we're seeing a pattern here. I think we know where Nate's coming from, and that's fine.
Okay. I think there's about 3,000 comments on there, and I'd say 80% mention the hands. Well, so let's draw a line under that.
It's fine. Yeah, the hands are bad. Look, this is the reason why I've gotten in trouble in the knife community, because I tell people stop doing those hand picks. And I actually got some messages. I got a message from the big man, and he was wondering what I was talking about. And these absurd pictures, and I'm going back to what I said in the last episode where I said stop taking hand pictures. Two reasons. One is nobody wants to look at your hands. Nobody, because nobody wanted to look at my hands, and I think my hands are better than yours. Except for Mareko. He prides himself on how nice his hands are. And the second is be original. But at the same time, people don't know how to work. They're stuck behind their cubicles wondering about their pedicures or their manicures. I see these guys with their soft hands, and when I shake them and they get that soft, clammy skin and it looks like they've never done anything. And it's like, I can't have faith in you. I can't have faith in you. That's what I have to say about that. Yeah, the hands are bad.
Yeah, hands are bad. Let's drop the hands. Let's drop the hands.
It's fine.
So we've been thinking of what
we're
going to talk about.
Thank God it's over, by
the
way. Thank God it's over, by the way. That was a little bit like, you know, I just, it's fine.
Something you'd do again?
Yeah, nothing made me, I mean, I'm not going to like pull the plug. I mean, that's fine. I'll do it again. You got 3,000 comments. You could probably read two of them. You read two of them an episode probably for a while. But I'm not going to put people through that again. Fingers, I know, hands. I got you.
This is our first show, really, of this new format. And
yes.
The whole purpose of this was really so we could get the tech right. We want it to be sounding great. We just want it to work really well for you.
That's what
we've asked people to do is send in questions. So we set up the Knife Talk podcast Instagram account. So myself, Jeff, and Mareko all have access to this account. So if you send any questions there, they'll come straight through to us. So I've noted a few down. So let's just answer people's questions for the show and see what we get.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
We've got a question from Carl Walter Tools. And this is a really good question, actually. He asked, do we have any ghetto processes to save in money and time? What do you think?
That whole expression, it's just like it's an easy way to say something. But, I mean, when you're a blacksmith or when you're a knife maker or you're someone who makes something, you got to be a little inventive. So everything can't be, out of a box. You don't buy everything. You got to make it happen. So in regards to efficiency and, I made my own forge. I didn't buy it. My opinion is you got to do whatever it takes, and I don't look down on people who try to figure out ways in which to make something happen when they don't have it.
No, I completely agree. I mean, there's a million and one ways to do things.
That's it.
And I hate that whole thing when somebody says, no, you're doing it wrong, you're using the wrong tool. But,
you know,
it works for me. It's all context, you know?
It's very strange how people do that. I've never understood that. It's this weird dominance thing. It's unnecessary. It's not totally unnecessary. So you do whatever it takes.
Yeah. So I'm going to share just a couple of those processes. I put one on Instagram this week was using just a silicone cupcake case.
I love that.
To mix my epoxy in. Because otherwise I'm mixing epoxy in every day and I was just throwing out all of these little cups, and it was just junk and it's landfill and it's not good. So get yourself a silicone cupcake case and then it just, when it's dried out and it's hardened up, you just peel it out, and you use the case again, and it comes out perfectly clean, perfect.
I love that you did that, and I'd like to just hop on that a little bit. I don't use throwaway sticks. What I do is I've gotten over the past years, I've been a painter, I've been a sculptor, so I have these tiny little painter's palette knives. And when I'm applying the epoxy, I use these small palette knives. They're not big. I mean, I do have like spackle knives that I use sometimes for scales because it's the same thickness as the scales when you're kind of laminating them together. But when you use those metal, like a palette knife, once it's dry, you take a razor blade and it just all comes right off. So I'm constantly, I love the idea of, I when I see those videos of people with the a million little Dixie cups and throwing everything away. Mm-hmm. It just kind of, there's always a better way to do it. But I love that idea. I love that silicone thing. I got to get me some silicone.
Cool. I've got another one as well, actually. So I shared this a long time ago. So we've all got our dunking tank, which we dunk our blades into, you know, next to our grinder to keep them cool and so on.
Yeah.
But I was finding that, you know, after a while, the blades will come out and they've got these bits of grind, you know, there's grind dust on them and they're going straight back onto the belt. And it's just scratching up all the time, you know? So I now use a steel bucket, and I'm going to be quite fancy here and explain that it's actually a champagne ice bucket.
I love it. High level. You know, high level.
Proper high level stuff. But I use a strong welding magnet then, which I put on the outside. So what happens then is when you dunk your blade back in, all that grind dust goes straight to the magnet. So it keeps the water much, much cleaner. So when you pull your knife back out, it's sparkling clean, ready to go back on the belt again.
Very tight.
It's avoiding those scratches and it's keeping those belts cleaner for, you know, much, much longer.
That's a good move. I love that magnet move.
Works well. Works really well.
I bet you could use like a galvanized bucket too. You don't have to have a champagne bucket.
Yeah. Well, you know. Champagne bucket, why not? If you've got a champagne bucket, use a champagne bucket.
Yeah, baby, come on. Get your champagne bucket. Come on.
We got a question from Prince Forgeworks, and he asked for any tips on heat treating and tempering of stainless. I'll let you go first with this.
Well, one thing is there are guys, I know that Nick Rossi over at the New England School of Metalwork, I know that he forges AEBL. I don't forge stainless steel because I don't really know. I don't know if I have confidence in it. I haven't done it myself, and buying blocks of stainless steel over an eighth of an inch thick can be expensive. An even heat kiln would be your best bet in regards to the heat treatment. The heat treatment is the hardest part because the critical temperature of the iron carbides in the stainless steel is much higher than being able to see it in a forge. Like, a lot of people, you can see critical temperature, a little bit above critical temperature with carbon steel. Once it's a little bit non-magnetic and then a little bit higher than that, that's critical temperature, but it's a little bit harder with the stainless. The other thing is you really want to use stainless steel foil to prevent carburization in the steel. That means the carbon's kind of going out to the outside of the blade. I love stainless steel. I would say 90%, 95% of my knives that I make are stainless steel. Get a good oven, get some aluminum blocks, get a compressor with some air, and get some. You don't need the expensive stainless steel foil. You only need the foil that goes up to, I think they have foil that goes up to 2,000 degrees and then up to 2,200 or 2,300. You're only going up to 1,950 at the most, so you can use the less expensive stainless steel foil. And the foil is going to keep that oxygen-free environment that's going to prevent carburization, and it's really going to make give you a better knife. The other thing is, in regards to heat treatment, I'll be super quick. Don't put in a distal taper when you're heat treating with plates, because if you put a distal taper in the spine, when you're quickly putting them between the plates, what will happen is you could cool them between the plates, not straight. So if you leave the distal taper out with your stainless steel, you keep that spine, the exact thickness of the spine, you're more likely to keep the knife straight. Those are the only tips I would do.
What do you do if you're heat treating more than one blade at a time, a stainless blade, for example, where obviously the temperatures are super high and you're using plates? How are you cooling those plates quickly then to get onto the next knife?
That's a very good question, because when I heat treat everything, I usually, I know a lot of guys heat treat like you know, five or six, you know, you can get, when you get your ovens, they give you like a little, you can get those little ceramic holders that hold like five or six knives. I try to stay away from, I don't heat treat more than three knives at a time. For that reason is because with the aluminum, your plates get hot. What I usually do is when I set my temperature, 1900 degrees, I have a holding period. And usually for me, I quench after 5 minutes. And then if you have I have the Even Heat LB. So the back of the kiln doesn't have coils, so it holds a kind of much easier heat. I'm always afraid that when the door opens and closes, you're going to lose a lot of that heat to kind of drop you out of the austenite phase. So I go with three maximum, and then in between, if I feel I have a lot of sets of plates, and for that reason, because I'm afraid that the plates get too hot and then they're not going to draw out the steel as quickly, converting the austenite into martensite. So I have a few different sets of plates, and then if it gets really hot, I have a bucket. I dump the plates in water really quick, and then I dry them off, and then I keep at it. But I try not to do. There's no point in doing. If you're trying to save time on one or two more knives, you're not gaining anything if they come out bad. You know, if you lose the heat treatment or you got to redo the heat treatment, there's no gain. If you don't have enough. Cool aluminum to heat treat. You get more aluminum or brace yourself for, you know, being able to figure out a way to cool it down. And when I was heat treating all the Cuban knives, I had to do 36 of them, and I was terrified that I would have my quench oil after a couple would be too hot. So I had a thermometer in my quench oil. I would heat treat two, and that would keep me under 120 degrees. I would keep the oil at around just under 100 degrees, and then I would hold off for a couple of, you know, like 30 minutes or so, and then I'd heat treat another. So I was able to heat treat eight a day, and I got good results, and I kept my oil cool without having to, you know, go bananas.
Yeah. Yeah, and with regards to stainless, because I know Prince Forge works, I think he's going to be working on some stainless Damascus.
He makes amazing Damascus, by the way.
He does some of the stuff that over the last couple of weeks specifically that he's posted has just been
crazy.
Incredible.
Crazy.
Yeah. But I'd say, yeah, like you said, get plates, lots of plates. They're cheap, you know, considering what you're making.
Right.
They're cheap. I use just a very sort of basic woodworker's vise, just so I can put the plates in so you can snap up really quickly. I created just a little lip on the bottom of the vises so I can slide new plates in. And what I tend to do is not take the old plate out, just put a new plate on top of that one. So again, I wouldn't do more than three or four at a time, but by that point you may have sort of three plates either side of the blade. But it's fine. You know, they stay cool and it just allows you to quench really quickly.
Can I tell you one thing about that? I had that the first in, I saw Kyle Daly did that. He had plates and he mounted them to his vise, and I did that. And one thing I realized was that I liked having them so I put one on the table and then I put the knife down and they put the other plate down. I had more control because once you get in, all this steel is the same. I mean, in regards to the heat treatment and the tempering, the concept is the same. So what you're doing is you're getting the steel to the austenite stage where the carbon is in solution throughout the knife, and then you're trying to cool it down below a certain amount of temperature, and then the austenite converts into martensite, right? So I realized that if I kept it in the plate, I couldn't tell if the knife was straight. And when you have it in those foil packages, you kind of still can't tell if it's straight. So what I do is I put a plate on the table, put my knife down, put the with my hand and a glove, I cool it down, and I get it below the 700 degrees. And then, when there's no color and everything like that, I cut off, I pull it out of the foil, and then I take a look, because you still have a little bit of that austenite converting into martensite. So it's the same thing with your quenching. When you're quenching, it doesn't have to be ice cold before you take it out to look. If you bring it out after 15 seconds, 20 seconds of quenching, there's still enough heat in there that if you have a warp, you can fix it. So my whole problem with the vise thing is I'm always like paranoid. Well, I don't want to have to fix the warp in the temper. If I can fix it before the temper, that's what I want to do, and that's usually what I do. So I don't use the vise. I go hand and then look and then.
Yeah, that makes sense. Makes sense. Yeah.
I don't like doing extra work. I hate it.
Yeah. Well, if you know, if there's a way around something that works,
yeah,
you know,
for sure.
Why would you go the long way around? You
know? Absolutely. Absolutely.
So we've got a question from, we've actually had a few questions from Christopher Hood 888, and he's on Instagram. But I've just chosen one of his questions.
Okay.
Where's the best place to purchase knife making supplies and grinders? And I suppose we're going to have very different answers for this because we're in different parts of the world.
Of course. Go ahead, start in.
For me, I'm in France, so weirdly, I don't actually get anything from France because it's so expensive.
I'm sure.
So I generally get stuff from the UK, and with shipping costs aren't too bad. There's no import taxes to pay because we're, at the moment the UK is part of the EU. So I use B&D abrasives and ground flat stock. Between those two, I get virtually everything that I need.
Right.
And yeah, occasionally I may need to, you know, find something a bit more locally. With regards to the handle materials, I'm pretty much self-sufficient on handle materials now when it comes to wood, just from sort of local places and actually from forests too, and just, you know, stabilizing them myself. But if I want G10 and stuff, I'll just go to groundflatstock.co.uk, and David is brilliant there. He'll get stuff out in the post that day. And I generally get it in about 2 days later, you know, and that's taking a plane over. That's doing everything. It's landed on my door 2 days later.
That's so amazing.
Can't really fault that.
It's too bad that it takes it's such a kind of a production for you to kind of get anything.
Yeah, I mean, when people think of France, they think of Paris, they think of big cities, you know.
Right.
I'm if you were to put a pin in the middle of France, that's where I am, the furthest away from a beach that I could possibly be, and I'm just surrounded by woodlands. So yeah, we don't have local stores to go to pick things up. Everything needs to be bought online. So yeah, it just makes sense and economically for me to get it from the UK. So I'm not sure where Christopher's from, whether he's in the US or whether he's in Europe or wherever. But for me, it's from the UK, and I generally use BND abrasives and ground flat stock.
Amazing. Well, over here in the United States, it's the land of opportunity. We get to buy whatever the fuck we want. Oh, pardon me. We get to buy whatever we want. And, you know, so I got all my grinders from Beaumont Metalworks, but my first grinders were just like, you know, Ryobis. I mean, they were just like what you'd get at a hardware store. All my grinders are Beaumont KMGs, and my disc grinders are Beaumont. I get a lot of handle material. All my G10 I get from Alpha Knife Supply. Sometimes I get my Corbies from Jan's Supply. I get this and that from Tracy over at USA Knife Maker. He's a dynamite guy. Actually, they have great videos too on heat treating, and they'll show you what to do. I get all my steel from the New Jersey Steel Baron. Sometimes I get a little bit of steel from Colonial over in Chicago. But, you know, there's here in the United States, if you have any questions, you feel free to DM me. But keep it to, don't be Nate.
It's a buyer's market.
Nate. Yeah, Nate, leave it alone, baby. I hope that wasn't Nate asking that question, was it?
It wasn't. we've got a question from your homie, Ed Jitz.
Love Ed Jitz.
He's asking about handle materials. So what is your favorite, whether it be bone, G10, micarta, wood? What do you prefer?
I don't know. You know, I stay away from that bone. I had some of that. I had some Jig Buffalo Horn, and it made my shop smell like a,
that
you know,
smell. It's like burnt hair. Well, I suppose it is hair. It's disgusting.
It's terrible. And, you know, you can just feel like some sort of sadness when you're grinding it. It's just awful. He likes that. He wants to stay away from that giraffe bone. He's all about that giraffe bone. I stay away from the bone for the most part. All that mammoth tooth, and this is not really for me. So when it comes to colors, I like that high color G10. I love most of my signature scales are royal blue and toxic green. I like the yellow too. In regards to micarta, I love the only micarta I really like is natural tan canvas micarta because it's got that kind of real texture, that canvasy texture. And then recently, I've been using a lot of I like stabilizing my own wood these days. I've been enjoying that. But I would go with G. If I had my choice, I'd go G10 all day.
Yeah, Yeah, and so, some of your patterns I love, actually. You have that sort of signature sort of blue and green, don't you, which I really like. Really
well, you know, that comes from my old art days. The funny thing about G10 is they don't give you tones. They don't give you shades. So a lot of times people are trying to match, and I always say to them, well, we can't do that, but what we can do is we can use contrasting colors to kind of activate each other's color. And all of a sudden you'll see these colors that you don't really think much of, and when you're kind of putting them together in these different combinations, they activate each other, they work together, and they kind of create something kind of interesting.
I've got a question actually about your G10 because I haven't been doing it this week because I've been out of the studio, but I've been working on a sort of an example knife for a couple of French chefs here in the area. So I'm using three layers of G10, just 1 mil layers, which is blue, white, and red for the French flag.
Right.
So they'll be closest to the blade. Then there's going to be a wooden sort of scale to it.
Yeah.
So when it comes to glue up, do you get all your G10 glued up ready so it's one solid piece, or do you just glue everything all in one and clamp up?
I always prep everything beforehand. I glue everything together because I don't want to fool around. I'd rather have a block. So if I have three colors, I'll laminate them all together, and then I'll laminate the scales individually, and to save on clamps, I'll laminate two sets of scales at the same time, I'll put a piece of Kydex in between because the epoxy doesn't stick to the Kydex, and I'll have three clamps holding together six pieces of G10 gluing together, and then when they're done, I snap off the Kydex because it doesn't the epoxy doesn't stick to the Kydex, and they'll do three tiny drops of crazy glue, and I'll put them together, and then I can shape everything. I can shape the bolster at the same together, so I can kind of make sure that they're even. But yeah, okay, I don't. Yeah, if you're putting them together one at a time, you also miss out on bubbles. They're if you're, you know, when you're doing the G10, you want to scratch it up a little bit. You want to make sure that, you know, the epoxy is adhering, because if you have that shiny part of the G10, the epoxy or the glue won't take. It'll just kind of be like going to glass. Yeah. So, but if you go too deep, sometimes what happens is you can have bubbles. So I would just be worried about that.
Okay. And would you laminate that sheets of G10, or would you cut them to scale size first and laminate small bits?
I know that Aaron Goff does that. He's got a big press and he'll put sheets together. I would be afraid of air bubbles in between, because if the air bubbles get hard and you cut into it, you'll have a little air bubble in between. So I try to get them as close as possible. Like I'll trim everything down to, you know, when they send you the sheets, they're smart. They make the sheets in the size that are pretty close to what knife makers use. So you can trim them down to, I'm going inches. Sorry. I don't know. So like inch and a half, and then two pieces, you know, they'll give you 11 inches or 11 and a half or whatever. And then you just, I run them down to inch and a half, and then kind of get them close and put them together close. It's easier, less clamps, less worry.
Okay, cool. So, I mean, generally, my knives are using wood. I just love the natural patterns. You know, I just find it really fascinating. Not two are ever the same. Like you, I stabilize myself. But, you know, if I get the odd customer who does need something that hasn't got a wooden handle, an example here, a butcher's here in France, they're not allowed to use wooden handles. They need to be a synthetic handle. I think that's to stop.
Is that right?
Yes, yeah, it's law. It's to stop the ingress of any sort of germs into the handle.
Wait, you know? But so you're not allowed to use wood, or you're not allowed to use?
Not allowed to use wood in commercial butcheries and abattoirs.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes 100% sense.
I suppose so. So in that case, I'd use G10. But yeah, as the same with you, with regards to bone, I've used it once. I found it very, very brittle and easy to sort of chip as well. But that smell was just...
That's not good.
Absolutely rank.
The one thing about the wood is the hardest part is if somebody wants a set. One thing is I've been working with this local mill, and they've been giving me like big pieces. So when I do sets, I can have the set, all the wood come from the same piece of wood, which is great. The hard part about buying wood is you don't really have that ability to kind of make sure things match. That's the only part about wood. You have to manage the expectations of your customers, Craig. You understand?
Yeah, well, yes. But I mean, as I say, I'm surrounded by woodland, so quite often I can go and see almost the whole tree. So it's something that I've been thinking of doing, actually, is providing a map with every knife that I sell, with a little pinpoint saying exactly where this wood was.
You know? My guys, the Danes, will tell you what street the tree came down from. It's great.
Yeah, Exactly. Yeah. So that's something I've been considering. But yeah, with regards to matching up wood, you know, I think I'm quite fortunate in the fact that, you know, I can get as much wood as I need from, you know, the same source.
That's excellent. I'm with you.
We've got a really good question from Josh Scott Knives, which is, where do you see the knife community in 5 years? And I'm really interested on your take on this, Jeff, because I've got a bit of a spiel about this myself. So let you go first on that one.
Well, my opinion is it depends on how knife makers treat their customers and treat the public at large. I think that this is an opportunity to train your customers in regards to what they want. There are a lot of times people will say, and I've heard knife makers, master and bladesmith, say that chefs don't really know much about knives. I've actually seen chefs who have been cooking for a long time, and when you talk to them about knives, they don't really have a good understanding about knives. I think that we have an opportunity to educate people in regards to what we're doing, and now's the time. There's been a really big interest in knives and knife making, and I think it's great, but I think that to make sure that it's not a flash in the pan thing, well, I think we need to be a little bit more educated in regards to how we talk to customers, and then creating this idea of, and this is what my business partner Tony and I talk about, of managing expectations, explaining what we're doing, let the people be involved, and then you're kind of cultivating more customers. So yeah, I think that it's based sense, on yeah. education and understanding is kind of pretty important.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to come at this from a slightly different angle. So with regards to, you know, knife making community, I'll talk more about knife makers. And I think we're living in a really magical time. We've got the combined knowledge of millions and billions of people at our fingertips, thanks to the internet.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'd never had this before. So in the past, knowledge would have probably taken decades to travel. It's, you know, left one village blacksmith onto the next, and he heard something from his brother who passed it on to the next.
Right.
So we're fortunate to have the internet, and I've been thinking about community a lot recently, particularly the knife making community. And I think there is a community out there. There's various Facebook groups. There's obviously Instagram. Even Twitter people are using, obviously, to sell knives.
Yeah.
But I'd love to bring all these people together in a place where the primary objective is just to help each other. Because we've all seen these forums, you know, these knife-making forums. And it's just like a dick-swinging contest, you know? Now, I've got no time
baby.
For that.
Nate, hold your ears, Nate. Hold your ears. Hold your ears, Nate. This one's for you, baby. We're gonna swing some dicks around here, Nate. Come on, baby. All right, go ahead. Sorry.
But I've got no time for that at all, you know? As I said, you know, everybody's got a different way of doing things, and everybody's got something that they can teach others. So I'd love to see a community resource that there's there for people that has people's back when they're struggling with something. Maybe, you know, it could be something like getting the correct finish on something, or maybe how to use a specific tool. I think there's enough knowledge out there for us all to sort of help each other.
Yeah, so, I agree. Totally agree.
So, I mean, that's one of the reasons for the podcast, you know? That's why I do this.
And the Instagram. I mean, I'm amazed at how many people reach out to me, and I've never not responded. It is a community, and it'd be great to have some sort of community gathering.
So,
not
so
for you, Nate, though. Not for Nate. Nate can stay home. Nate stay is home,
banned. Nate. So I've been working on a forum for Knife Talk. So we're going to have Knife Talk, the podcast, which is what you're listening to at the moment. But there's also be a forum, 100% free. It'll be self-policed, sort of within reason. And let's just see what comes of it, because, you know, there are other knife-making forums out there.
Right.
But I do think that we are part of a community here. And, you know, a lot of my followers on Instagram, they listen to the podcast. And I'm sure there's other pools of, you know, other communities out there, which, you know, we haven't tapped into, and maybe that'll come over time. I don't know. But, you know, it's going to be great to have this resource for people alongside the podcast. I've actually got plans to take, you know, steps a little further as well, but it's early stages for that.
But
I think it's going to be fun and useful.
Yeah.
So that's the main thing. It needs to be useful. No dick swinging, completely useful. You're there to help.
A little dick swinging. Just a little bit, baby. Come on, Craig. Just a little bit of dick swinging.
Maybe just a bit.
Swinging
maybe just
dicks,
a bit.
Baby. Come on. A little bit.
But it would be lovely to have a bit for, you know, I mean, myself, you, and Mareko. We all make culinary knives.
Right.
So let's have a little bit for chefs. you know, and where, you know, chefs could be taught how to use their knives, how to sharpen them properly. It doesn't just have to be for knife makers. So that's going to be forum.knifetalk.net.
Ooh.
That should
forum,
be live.
Wait, let me just make sure I got that right. Forum.knifetalk.net. All right, writing it down.
So that should be live by the time this podcast goes live. Use it as you please. It may come to nothing, but it may become a resource. And, you know, if you've got some time, answer people's questions. If you've got any questions, ask away, and I'm sure people will be more than happy to help out. And that's what it's all about.
I'd like to add, too, that I think one of the things that we should try to focus on in regards to this podcast is I think that we can talk to people who are new to knife making and people who are older at knife making, but I think it would be great to try to bring in people like chefs. I mean, we're all, let's face it, it's more culinary guys in this, because that's what we do. You know, you, me, and Mareka, we all might culinary guys. It would be great to kind of like have conversations and talk to chefs in regards to what they're looking for. Sometimes we think we know what they're looking for and we don't, you know, so
exactly.
This forum makes sense in regards to getting that feedback from chefs and kind of figuring out where we need to go.
Exactly.
Outstanding. Well, good for you, man.
Cool.
I'm with it.
So let's get a bit technical. Running Man Forge has asked, and this one's for you, Jeff, because I've got no idea what he's talking about. No idea at all.
All right.
Could you explain the spheroid, what spheroides process?
I think it's spherodizing. So
spherodizing,
so,
right.
Look, here's one thing. I read that before, and I was kind of like, well, number one, thank you for writing that question. Number two, I am repelled by scientific talk, and it's like I cannot tell you when people it really, this knife making thing, to, you know, I really feel strongly about learning stuff so you can understand it. So you've made Running Man Forge, I'm with you, but you made me work on this one because I didn't know exactly. But then I have this way of explaining some types of scientific processes so people understand. If you start talking about, so spheroidization is basically it's annealing the steel. So when you have, when you, I'm talking basically, don't at mention me and say, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. So what I try to do is I try to explain things the way I would understand them. And what I, how, the way I understand, I think that if we go back and if I go over 5 minutes, just pull the hook on me. So spheroidization is basically, you're annealing the steel and you're at a lower temperature than the critical temperature for a long period of time, and then it's becoming workable. So when you get your steel from a steel supplier, it isn't pre-heat treated. If it was pre-heat treated, you wouldn't be able to cut it with a bandsaw. You wouldn't be able to drill it, right? So I'm going to just do this quick introduction in regards to what heat treatment is. And if new guys, here's how you're going to understand it. And old guys, here's how you're going to explain it. You have to look at heat treatment like you would a dessert creme brulee. So if you look at creme brulee and you have your little cup of custard, you sprinkle some sugar on the top. Look at the sugar on top. Think of the sugar on top as the iron carbides, right? So you have your, this, when you, that sugar that you sprinkle on top of the custard, it has no connection with each other. It's very like, yeah, they're individual granules. So when you apply heat to that sugar, what happens is there's a critical temperature where all the sugar starts to melt. And when they start to melt, they kind of bond into each other, right? They're now in solution. So at a particular heat, at a particular temperature, that sugar goes into this kind of liquid pool on the top of your creme brulee, right? That would be austenite. That's the same thing that happens with your, when you're heat treating a knife. You're bringing the steel up to the critical temperature, not the temperature that melts the steel, but the temperature that melts the iron carbides into solution in the steel. And it spreads out like that, that sugar, right? So you got the sugar in your creme brulee and it's all melted and liquidy. As it cools down by itself, it turns from a liquid into a hard, brittle structure, right? That would be the martensite. So you're converting the austenite, the liquid iron carbides, into martensite, this hard, brittle situation. Now, the similarities are very similar because with the creme brulee, you want to smash through it easy with your spoon. It's the same thing once you have your martensite. You have to, it's a very hard and brittle. So when it's hard and brittle, you have to temper it, and then tempering it is kind of bringing back some of that, is bringing back some of that martensite into that, into, and you're cooling it off, you're chilling it out, you're bringing it back a little bit so it becomes flexible, right? So spheroidization is basically if you were to have a hard piece of steel, they either work hardened or sometimes, like I just, I had to anneal this. When you're making Damascus, once you make your build of Damascus, you actually have to anneal it. You have to bring it back because those iron carbides, when they're spheroidized, there's no connection between them. So when you bend it, that's the reason why it holds its shape, because there's no connection. Once you have the martensite, you do the austenite and the martensite, the martensite has that lattice work that makes it not hold its shape when you bend it. So that's spheritization. It's annealing. And I didn't want to do this. I don't hate science talk. However, feel free to use the creme brulee reference. I talked to some chefs at Stone Barns. They have understood it. Otherwise, they're going to go to sleep. You have to figure out ways in which to educate these people. And I can't take it anymore. So thank you. And God bless. I can't. That's all I got. Annealing. It's a softer state of your iron carbides.
Every day is a school day with Jeff.
I'm repelled by myself right now. Totally repelled.
Northwestern Knives. He's asking, what tools can knife makers not live without? And this is a difficult one because everybody's obviously very different. You know, there's more than one way to crack an egg.
Right.
But for me, I mean, obviously the standard 2x72 grinder makes it possible to turn out knives in a timely manner. But I think this is a leading question because I actually use a grinding jig which was made by Northwestern Knives, which I use for smaller knives to get them repeatable.
He used to be Basher Dan.
He did, Basher Dan, yes. Yeah. I think he's now Northwestern Knives on Instagram.
I love that guy. I like Basher Dan better, I think, but I think
it's a cool name. Yeah, yeah.
I'm with you.
For me, it's my grinder, obviously at 2x72. And I think if you've got a grinder, you've got a drill press, and you've got an even heat, you've got everything you need, really.
Well, I'm going to take a different end because it just so happens that I made a tool yesterday that is now my favorite tool right now. And this is a blacksmithing thing. And when you're forging knives and you're forging the bolster of an integral knife, or if you're folding if you're trying to get your heel that 90 degrees from the bolster, what you want is a butchering tool. What a butchering tool is, and actually I've just been working with Lynn Ray, who makes the best blacksmith knives, and I made a watercolor drawing of his process, and he has it on his Instagram page. You need a butchering tool. Butchering tool is basically something you hold in your hand, in your hammer hand, and not your hammer hand, in your managing hand, and then you put it down on the steel, and then you hit it with your hammer, and what that does is it incises into the steel. So if you're imagining an integral knife, you know, integral has that integrated bolster, that transition between the blade to the bolster is almost like a radius. Well, if you have a butchering tool, what you do is you take your knife and you put it into the leg vise with the knife facing up, and then you can take the butchering tool and actually kind of incise some radius into your bolster. So the butchering tool for me, and just a little piece of advice, if you go on YouTube and you look for, what am I whispering? This is ridiculous. So if you go to YouTube and look up Nick Rossi, he did an incredible video on forging integral knives, and he uses a butcher tool. So give that man credit. Nick Rossi, New England School of Metalwork, best in the biz. So butchering tool is my new favorite tool. It's going to be great.
Cool. Okay. Florentine Sotoma over at Florentine Knives.
Love that guy.
Man, have you seen his shop? The more pictures he's posting, the more
I might go see his shop. He's been trying to get me to come out to Spain, and he's got that little lure hanging up, and I'm about to bite. So I want to get to see him soon. I love what he's doing.
We should have a meetup in Spain. That would be cool.
Maybe we have some. Maybe now, Tomer, the ball's in your court, you motherfucker. We got to get this thing rolling.
But he's asked for any tips for a good finish on stainless blades, and this couldn't have come at a better time because I've been struggling with this for so long. But just last week, I had my mind blown. So I was speaking to Fingal Ferguson down in Gabin.
Awesome.
There.
Awesome dude.
Amazing. He makes these beautiful knives. And I said to him, how are you getting this finish on stainless? Because it was almost a mirror polish, and he's knocking these knives out quickly. And I was just, how the hell are you doing that?
Oh, I want to hear this.
And he told me, and it's my new favorite thing. So, you know, I was doing the usual thing of, you know, going through my grits up to about 400. Then I was using Scotch-Brite belts. And then I'd go to hand sanding. And as you know, as soon as you start hand sanding after using a Scotch-Brite belt, it looks like shit and it's going to take you a long time.
Right.
So, you know, stainless was just too hard to do anything in a reasonable amount of time for me. Not saying it's impossible, but in a reasonable amount of time.
It's hard, baby.
Yeah, so I have just got some Scotch-Brite deburring wheels, which they fit on your bench grinder. They're, you know, you'd almost sort of 6-inch wheel with a, you know, an inch arbor to put them on the grinder.
Yes.
And they work like a dream. So they give you that Scotch-Brite finish, that satin finish, but obviously the scratch pattern is running parallel with the tang.
Right.
So it's the perfect way. But they make them ultra fine. So you can start with, you know, a medium, then go to a fine.
But so what happens if you have a plunge line?
Ah, well, that'll be different. I generally don't. That's so obviously it depends on what, you know, your style of knife, I suppose.
I'm out.
But what I'm doing now is going from on the normal belts, going, you know, 80, 120, 200, 400, then going to my Scotch-Brite belts. So going through the, you know, the brown, then the maroon, then the gray, then the blue. And then taking it to these wheels, these deburring wheels. And a great tip I had from Fingal was when he's telling me about these wheels. I said, well, they sound great, but they sound scary as hell. Because I hate using wheels on the grinder.
Yeah.
Because they're grabby and, you know, they're dangerous.
Most dangerous thing there is.
Exactly. So what he does, he clamps his blades just to a 2x4.
That's it.
So you've got, you know, something big to grip hold of. So I tried that just last week, and it's fantastic. You get a perfect finish on stainless in a tenth of the time. So grab yourself some of those Scotch-Brite wheels. They're deburring wheels. It took me a while to find them online. So they're 3M wheels. The code is DB-WL. I got these from, the best price I could get was from BND Abrasives. They sell them, you know, in quite a few places, but BND Abrasives were great price. And just get, you know, get a couple, get the fine, get the medium. And because they're Scotch-Brite belts, they don't sort of wear out. They wear, but, you know, each turn gives you the same amount of grit. You know, the grit doesn't wear out. It's just the wheel itself will wear out. That's a great finish.
That's awesome. Well, you
know, it saves a lot of time.
It's funny because I used to work in a metal finishing shop and we did a ton of mirror finish bronze and we had to deal with these big buffers. So what we would do is we would attach it to a long 2x4 and then we had like a stand that was up on the wheel, right under the wheel. So you have that long 2x4, you're not that close, but then you have a little bit more leverage and you can really kind of push it into the buffing wheel. So that's awesome. He has plunge lines. I wonder how he takes care. He has to go manually with those little plunge lines.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, just to finish up those plunges, maybe. I don't know. But you know, it works.
It's awesome.
Works so well. And you know, you could take that then to a buffing wheel to get the mirror finish if you wanted. But it just gets rid of those scratches. It's super fast.
Outstanding.
Yeah, it works really well.
I'm a disc sanding guy. I go belts to the disc sander to take all the high spots off, and then I'm only hand sanding for like an hour and a half per knife.
Hmm. And do you have a different process for a stainless blade as you maybe a carbon blade?
No, I do. It's all the same. I just kind of run down the belts, and I really don't go to – I go 36 to 80, then I use a gator belt, and then I go from the gator belt to a Scotch-Brite belt, and then I go to the disc grinder – and I go 120 to get the 120, and then you're changing the scratch pattern off with the disc grinder. And then I jump down from 120 to 220 to 320. And by the time I get to 320, you've taken all, you know, the whole thing about hand sanding is the valleys, the deepest part is your starting
peaks
spot.
And troughs, yeah.
So if you have a disc grinder and you kind of you're taking off the tops of all your scratches. So you're actually, it's doing the hard, it's flattening everything. And then by the time you get to hand sanding, you've already taken the majority off and it's pretty flat. So I've been having real good success with that. And that's been real helpful to me. I mean, it isn't, you know, magic, but it's what I like, and I've been getting my results have been the best with that. And, you know, putting your hands, you got to do something. You got to figure it out.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that Scotch-Brite wheel, though. That Scotch-Brite wheel is a dynamite idea.
Yeah, you know, they're not cheap, but you know, they're going to last. And
what's,
you know,
cheap?
Exactly. Cheap. If it saves time, it's cheap. You know.
That's what you have to look at with your sandpaper. You know, I buy Rhino wet sandpaper, and it's a little bit more expensive, but it's so much better. And what happens is you just, with all these abrasives, you're supposed to use them like they don't cost money, because otherwise you're wasting your time. You're not saving money on pushing dead, you know, sandpaper around.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, cool. So we were going to have this at a half an hour
show. I love that. I was going to kill you. At 45 minutes, I was going to kill you. I was going to be like, yeah, 30 minutes. Yeah, nice try. An hour works.
Let's, fine. Let's finish with one more question. This is from Blades of Belak. And I think this is going to be
specific. That's Caleb. Caleb rules. I love that guy.
This is going to be specifically for you, I think, right, Jeff, because he asked, when you get overloaded, what tasks can you pass on to any interns or apprentices that you may have?
Well, look, my opinion is in regards to this being a business, is this is your business. What this is not like the restaurant business where there's this expectation that you're going to get your first course within 10 minutes. You have to manage the expectations of your customers, and you can't panic, because once you start panicking, and don't sit there. I know, Caleb, you're sitting there saying, oh, I'm not saying I was panicked. What I'm saying is you're dictating the schedule as perfectly as you can with what you're doing. You can't overthink everything. You have to do one step at a time. And once you do one step at a time, you become a little bit less overwhelmed. I hate the feeling of I haven't been overwhelmed. I'm working on 100 knives right now, and I have not felt overwhelmed, because I'm trying to keep my mind right in regards to, this is the way I do it. I'm giving it my all, and that's that. When I start off with interns and I have some potential employees coming in, I always start them off with hand sanding, because I had to create a hand sanding system that was super easy to teach, and I was getting consistent results every time. My hand sanding techniques were the perfect way to get people. Also, you let them sit around for, you know. I don't mind. I mean, you put them in a, you know, how much damage can they do? I have a system that really works very easily. And when I teach you the first time, you get consistent results in regards to your hand sanding. I think hand sanding is great. Laying out, sometimes I'll have somebody put the dicom down on the steel, and then they'll trace out my templates. Hand sanding for me is, I've gotten it down, so that's what I push off a lot of hand sanding on. And then whatever they feel confident. Some of these kids, they show up and they ask you stupid questions, and some of the questions are so stupid that you're terrified. With that said, you get yourself a waiver. You got to get yourself a waiver, because there's nothing worse than I had an intern once say to me, what happens if I touch this? And he was pointing at the 36 grit on the grinder, and I said, nothing, because I'm not going to let you use it. You got to kind of feel everybody out. Hand sanding is always good. You know, it's dangerous. I get very nervous when I look for employees, and I look for people to progress. I really stress the idea of safety, because and safety isn't just because wearing your eyeglasses all the time. It's like when you're using the saw and all of a sudden you're pushing it from both sides, and then it binds the blade, and all of a sudden everything stops. And what do you do? How do you adjust? Having someone learn the confidence in what they're doing, where they're not just like drilling and all of a sudden the fucking steel starts spinning because they didn't realize that they're going too fast, or that it's popping through and it catches. What do you do? There's a lot of teaching people confidence and tools and letting them progress themselves. There's the short answer. The long answer's tomorrow.
How long are your apprentices generally staying with you for?
Well, here's the thing. You know, the apprentice, I don't consider that. You know, I see this not like, I don't really do the whole, I'm a bladesmith and these are my apprentices. I come at it from the old school arts world and metal shop. So I call them interns, or I call them, I try to make this is more like a metal shop than it is some, you know, this fairy tale of what people think a knife shop is. So a lot of the times it's usually, based on their school. Like I had a lot of high school kids who use this as their, senior project. So it's based on their schedule too. Over the summer, I had two great interns. One went back to college, and then one started school again. So it's really, you know, you're getting free labor, but you're also giving too. So it all depends. It all depends on what they want, and it gets to the point where hopefully you're giving them the you're giving them the training that it's worth it for you to kind of say, all right, listen, let me give you a couple bucks to stick around.
That's the story.
Now we got to start paying people.
Yes. That's when things get real.
That's fine.
When you're paying for other people's mortgages.
Well, no one's getting their mortgage paid at this shop. That's for sure. That's so true.
I think that's the quote of the podcast. Nobody's getting their mortgage paid at this shop.
Well, I mean, it's like, you know, the funny thing is we've made the adjustment to this being a real company. This isn't one of those things where, you know, you're just sending me PayPal and we are done with it. I have a business partner. We pay rent on two spaces. We want to be by the books. We want this to be legit. And I think it's very important. One of the things I think that the takeaway really is, I think that it's very important to have a business plan and a short-term plan and a long-term plan, because as my partner Tony Iazzi says, creativity isn't a business plan. You got to like figure out ways in which this is, you know, you can, you know, monetize your creativity in a way that, you know, you're paying for your mortgage and you're making this thing something real. So that's it. I'm with you. Ugh, that fucking expression. I hope that thing goes away.
It's stuck.
Someday we'll have to tell you the real story of I'm with you, because it's kind of hairy. That's a good cliffhanger.
Really?
That's a radio tease right there, baby. Craig, that's a radio tease.
Sure is. So I think this went well.
I loved it.
The listeners think the same. Uh-huh. I think we're onto something.
Well, we'll see. We've got to get Mareko in here, get his ass over here, and we'll see how it goes. I think the most important thing is consistency in terms of putting it out. I think that there are going to be times where one of us is going to say can't do it, and I think we're just going to have to. Instead of delaying it, I think we should do it anyway. I think people have expectations of every Monday. Yeah. They want to see something, and I'm happy to, whatever I can do to make that happen, obviously. And we got to develop some chemistry. So I think that we're going to have to, you know, everyone's going to have to pay attention, and you're going to have to see if we're trying. I'm not just shooting my mouth off every 5 minutes. We're trying to have a real conversation here.
Exactly. So people can listen on, obviously, knifetalk.net. On Spotify, on iTunes, and on any of the sort of podcasting networks, we're going to be there. The branding may change slightly over the next week, so, you know, it might not look like us, but if it says Knife Talk, it's going to be us.
And the other thing is we're going to do a lot with the Instagram page. So if you follow Knife Talk and the podcast, we're going to probably, what we'll do is we'll do a lot of stories, maybe we'll do some live once in a while, and then when we post... Maybe what we should do is, Craig, is when we post an episode, that particular post gives you the information and, you know, some, you could actually, we could probably add, if we talk about like the butchering tool, maybe we could add that to one of the images. So when you're watching, you can see all the things that on that particular episode, that particular post. Does that make sense?
Perfect. And if, you know, if we've got any links to add to stuff that we've talked about, okay, maybe Instagram isn't the right place for links because it doesn't really work.
No.
But maybe that's a good place then for the forum. So remember, the forum's going live this week, and we can have a little thread on there about the podcast, and we can add in extra descriptions and all that kind of stuff.
Outstanding.
Yeah, so knifetalk.net, which will be the home for the podcast, the home for the forum, Knife Talk podcast on Instagram. Any questions, get them over to us. And yes, we hope you all have a great week.
See you later, everybody.